A couple of years ago, before we ended the show's original run, I sat down with Guy Nofsinger, Jim Janicki, and Jeff Riegel of the Lost Clipper team. The story they told me then, and the one that continues tonight, is utterly amazing. It's a story that the world may not be ready to accept or believe. Was the crew of the Lost Clipper really sent to retrieve Amelia Earhart in exchange for a $3 million ransom? Tonight, Guy and Jim returned to the show to tell us what they've been up to in the years since, and they brought along a couple more members of their team. Two men whose voices you might never expect to hear on an Amelia Earhart podcast. This is Guy Nofsinger, Jim Janicki, Steve Murphy, and Javier Pena.
My favorite word of folks tonight. I'd like to welcome back returning guests Guy Nofsinger and Jim Janicki. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us, Chris.
Absolutely. And, we're not done yet, though. Guy and Jeff are not alone tonight. Joining them are two men that really don't need any introduction, but we'll give them one anyway. Steve Murphy and Javier Pena. This is, as I said offline, a true honor. Welcome to Chasing Earhart, gentlemen, both of you.
Thank you, Chris. We're honored to be here with you. And we're questionable about Guy and Jim, but we'll hang in there.
Great guys.
It's already started.
Great guys, and looking forward to it, Chris.
Right away. We're not going to waste any time. Now, as I said, if you haven't got a chance to listen to their first appearance on the show from a couple of years ago now, I encourage you to do so. And we'll, of course, link that original episode in the show's notes for tonight's conversation. If there's any doubt, that Javier and Steve might lack the professional credentials to appear on this show, let's dispel all of that right now. Tonight, we'll begin with Mr. Steve Murphy. For the people that will be listening to this, can we begin by asking you to give us just a little bit of your professional background, sir?
And before jumping in front, doing a body block, I want to make sure that we also recognize Jim Janicki.
Yes.
He is a critical success element for the Lost Clipper project as well. So I want to make sure he's teed up at the beginning and ready to go.
Oh, I'll get to Jim for sure. Absolutely.
And I agree 100% with what Guy just said. And you won't hear me say that very often, but I do on that, Jim.
Glad it's recorded.
There you go.
So, Chris, thanks. I'm a retired 38-year law enforcement professional, 6 years as a city cop in Southern West Virginia, 6 years as a railroad cop, and then 26 years as a DEA agent. Been retired now since 2013. And Javier and I have a worldwide speaking business that we travel around the world, do keynote presentations to conferences and corporations and theaters. And basically anybody's got a checkbook and they're willing to pay for it and pay our expenses, we'll come over. And we've got a podcast now out, Game of Crimes. Our website's deanarcos.com. But one of the biggest projects we're working on is what we're going to talk about tonight. And that's the Lost Clipper. We've been working with Guy now for 5 years on this. And I know we'll get into it, but I was fortunate enough to make the last trip with him when we went over to Micronesia. So I won't go into any detail there, but having a blast, man. Life's an adventure, and this is another adventure. So just tickled to death to be here with y'all tonight.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Pena, how about you, sir?
Thank you, Chris, for inviting us. And like I said, I'm excited. You know, I'll be very honest. My part in this is minimal, but I do have a little where I can help out. But basically the same thing with Steve. I did 30 years with DEA, 7 years with the Sheriff's Office in Laredo. I've had a great career. It was fun. A lot of trying times also, as you know, with DEA. So with this project, it's fascinating. Can't wait to get into it. You know, we're ready.
All right. Well, Guy, there are few stories that have the opportunity to turn this entire case on its head. And it's a juggernaut of a case, as you are well aware. For those that haven't heard that original episode and have no idea what the hell we're talking about tonight, can you give listeners a breakdown of the story as you theorize it unfolded?
Sure, certainly. So, and I would like to start, you know, Javier underplays his part. He can be a humble guy. And I will just say that, and picking up from where he left off, that Javier found himself as a bridge between an eyewitness of the Lost Clipper Project, bridging the past with the future, using his specific mm-hmm. skill of him and Steve of interviewing eyewitnesses and really gauging their authenticity. Are they a real truth teller, or are they looking for something? And I got to sit there and have a front row seat in San Antonio, Texas, where Javier was interviewing the daughter of Jose Sauceda, who was the third pilot on board the Hawaii Clipper, who told his parents when he picked up his entire family and moved them from San Francisco to San Antonio, Texas, because he was fearful that he would not return in any short amount of time from his mission flying the China Clipper, or the Hawaii Clipper, I mean, to Guam and then eventually to the Philippines. So he picks up his whole family and tells his dad, hey, if I don't come back in a year, tell my family, tell my wife and kids that I died probably at the hands of the Japanese, bringing ransom money for Amelia Earhart. We went to go rescue Amelia Earhart. And I brought a bunch of books and papers and pictures of Jose Sauceda. And we went to the daughters, the family of Sauceda, and Javier did his magic. He asked questions three different ways, was assessing how she was recalling things, why she was saying what she did. I never had a skill like that. Mine was more in books and research, which basically takes me to the beginning of this. This was actually research evolution for when I was working on my master's degree at the Strategic Intelligence Command and at DIA. And we were there and I was doing this course, and I wanted to do a thesis on the Navy perspective of looking for Amelia Earhart. And I came across the story of an Amelia Earhart hunter by the name of Joe Gervais in his trip to in 1964 to Truk Lagoon, because he had heard there was a crashed Electra on an island called Tonawas or Dublon at the time. So he finds a guy and he goes there looking for this Electra, and it wasn't. It was actually a Betty bomber that was upside down, a Japanese Betty bomber. And he said, well, easily I can tell this is not Electra. But the guy that he had hired to take him there said, yeah, well, what about the 15 Americans? He goes, what 15 Americans? He goes, the 15 Americans that were buried here before the war. And he goes, I don't know anything about them. And he goes, I'll show you. So they go to this concrete slab, and he goes, how do you know? He goes, well, there are 13 Caucasians, an Asian, and a quote-unquote dark guy. He goes, all right, where? And he goes, they were layered in four rows here, 4443. This was, they're oriented north, and I helped lay them out. They were already dead when I got here. I didn't kill them, but they were already here. So he gave the whole story, and Gervais took a picture of the slab, filed it away, because he wasn't looking for 15 Americans of unknown origin. He was looking for Amelia. This is 64. Flash forward to 1980, and a guy named Ron Jackson writes a book called The China Clipper, which was actually about the Hawaii Clipper. And in it, he writes about these 15 Americans, 13 Caucasians, an Asian, and a Hispanic, a Latino. That's the dark guy that no one knew about. And Joe Gervais, light bulb appears in his head. He goes, oh, that must be the passengers and crew of the Hawaii Clipper, 15. I mean, if you think about the odds of 15 being 13 Caucasians, an Asian, and a Hispanic, that's a really rare thing, disappearing before World War II.
Yeah.
So he works with another guy named Charlie Hill, and they write the book Fix on the Rising Sun. And that's the book that I came across. And then I met Charlie Hill many times and spoke at length, you know, about this. And I heard his theories, but he had never been to Truk Lagoon. So based on his information, I go to Micronesia four times looking for the remains of the Hawaii Clipper. And we discover new things that were never written in any book. And we find the actual area where the slab is. And on the fourth trip, that's when Steve Murphy comes out with me, you know, to verify everything on that end. Javier was on the domestic side doing his part. And also that is when Jim Janicki came on board. And Jim is a man of extreme many talents. Not only is he a pilot, he's a celestial navigator. He's a chemical engineer. He's a search and rescue dog team handler and a sailor. And
that's 10 all
other things. He's the guy everybody wants to be.
Wax too. And a floor wax too.
And it was actually his research and actually with his wife together building a replica of a stone monument, basically, as we like to call it, you know, as a one-to-one scale, working parallax with camera out in a park and the whole thing. That helped us figure almost exactly where the bodies had been laid. And he also was the guy who answered two of the most interesting trivial questions about the Hawaii Clipper's disappearance. The oil slick that was never directly attributed to it, and also why the cable communications broke out. He figured out by himself, with his experience, also being a ham radio operator and everything else, figured out why everything happened. And it finally solidified, I think, the strongest case ever that the Hawaii Clipper survived. It did not crash, and its passengers were abducted by organized criminals in the Japanese Navy and were murdered on Truk Lagoon. I know that's a roundabout kind of string theory type of thing, but I wanted to include everyone and give them their part to tee up this. But hopefully, Chris, you can edit something out of that.
No, I think we're going to keep it. I think we're going to keep it, to be honest with you. So, Jim, now that Guy's properly built you up as the icon you are, let's talk a little bit about this. The trailer, again, we'll link this in the show notes because it's an amazing trailer for Lost Clipper for this project. It's out there. It's on YouTube. Again, check the show notes tonight. We'll have a lot of information in there for people to do more research. But Jim, I mean, you're doing, as you just heard Guy say, you're doing a lot of different things. You're wearing a lot of different hats. Where do you even start with a story like this? Because a story is presented to you, you come on board, what is it? And then, of course, I'll ask Steve and Javier after this, but what brings you in? What initially compels you to say, okay, all in, let's do it?
You know, the mystery is so interesting. It really pulls you right in. And Guy's story is what pulls you in. I didn't want to get involved unless I could add some value. And what really helped me, Guy says, hey, you know, you did all this on your own. That's not true. You know, Guy allowed me to look at, I don't know, probably 20 years of Freedom of Information Act details. And I literally had no idea if I could help out. I just started reading things. And every weekend I'd sit down and read through. And I started to see some things and I'm like, oh, maybe I could add some value here. And yeah, I have all these kind of things I'm interested in. I'm a very curious person. I'm a voracious learner. I have a lot of certifications. I'm also a pilot. Like you said, I'm a sailor, navigation. But all those things he talked about, I could relate to the people of 1938 flying this airplane as a pilot, navigating, since I'm certified in celestial navigation, which is what they were using. The sailors who went to this oil slick, I know what they're like. I know their experiences. I know the difference in smell between diesel fuel and gasoline. And I can read the reports and understand each of these people's perspective. Even the chemical analysis was interesting because I'm actually a chemical engineer and I'm a licensed professional engineer, which means I can be a professional witness in a court of law as well from an engineering perspective. And I started looking at it from those perspectives and I realized there's something here. And I started looking at all these details, and from a technical perspective, there's some real reason to look into this, to say this looks like it could have happened. Little things show up, like the sailors say, hey, this oil slick in the middle of the South Pacific in 1938, there's an oil slick they run across. Do you know how hard it is to run across an oil slick? There's nobody out there. So they run across this oil slick, right? And they say it smells like gasoline, and they test it. And they don't test any gas. Without going into the technical details, I looked at the tests they used. They would never have detected the gasoline, but your nose would, by far. And I gave Guy a real analysis on it and showed him why that's the case and did all the calculations. But things like that started to come together. And we started to figure out, hey, these guys might have landed and refueled and spilled some gasoline in their landing oil. And that's exactly what this would look like and smell like. And it's exactly how it would have tested. And so you start to see, and that's just one thing. There were others that kept happening. And I said, you know, I got to tell Guy this stuff. And it all came from the information he provided me and just spending days and days reading through it.
I'll get the other side of this answer in just a second. But Javier, you and Steve, really, I mean, you've had storied careers, to say the very least. Certainly neither of you need this case. So what attracts you initially?
Well, Guy and I have been friends for quite a long time through mutual acquaintances. I used to live in Northern Virginia. And there's another person that's not here with us, Jeff Regal, who has participated in this with Guy, has been involved with it much longer than I have. And it turns out Jeff and I were friends, or we were actually neighbors in the same neighborhood in Northern Virginia there. As I said a while ago, I've always looked at life as an adventure. You know, as a Christian, I tell the good Lord, hey, you open a door for me, I'll step in it and see what's there. And if it's not what I'm supposed to be doing, then just show me where the next door is. Don't let me be disappointed. So in this case, when Guy told me about his idea of what he was doing, all the work he'd put into this, what he was looking for, hey, would you and Javier consider, and he and Jeff had done some filming for us. I forgot to mention that. We spoke to a corporate event and we were just getting started with our speaking business. They were the only videographers that we knew. They had the equipment. Their price was right. They did it for free.
Always the best price.
Oh, yeah. And trying to help us out, get started. And it just kind of grew from that, the friendship and the respect for each other. Just listening to the guy's story there just a second ago, I'm getting all excited again about the whole adventure. I've been a lot of places in the world, most of the time with Javier, but to go to Micronesia. Have you ever been to Micronesia?
No.
And most people, that's their answer.
Yeah.
And now I can say I've been there. And it was just met some fantastic people over there. We had an adventure. Didn't pay off like we hoped it would, but you know, we think now that we got Jim Jim on board with his research and his expertise, and you know, his wife giving him the okay to go with us. We think you've got a real shot at finding this on the next trip, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's compelling, certainly. You know, Javier, there must be something, I mean, for you, very enticing as an investigator, right? To get the opportunity to resolve maybe not one, but two very high profile historical cases like these. I mean, how much of that factored into your decision to get involved?
No, of course, of course. And you know what, when you look at this, I mean, this could change the course of history, right? I mean, yeah. This, you know, when it's proven, it's going to change history. But you know what, when Guy invited me and when we interviewed the lady, Captain Soso's daughter here in San Antonio. And you know what? With DEA, you learn a lot of tricks on interviewing and who's BSing, you know, who's trying to con you, and you can tell who the truth people are, the BS. And you know what? I still remember that interview, and this lady was telling the truth. And that to me is something where, you know, I could tell she wasn't lying. She remembers details. She had newspaper articles. Her dad brought all the family together. And you know what? And at this time, I think he's also like the first Hispanic pilot back then, right? I mean,
I don't think
there was too many Hispanic pilots back then. But the way she remembers that meeting when the dad got everybody together and explained to them this was a very dangerous mission. There was a possibility that he was not coming back. So that immediately triggered, wow, here we have, it's a witness. She heard from her dad about this trip, about the dangers, about the money, about Amelia Earhart. So that to me, of course, it's got my curiosity. In all my experience, like sitting, talking to people, interviewing witnesses, informants, his daughter was telling the truth, which is amazing. And this is why this is so interesting.
I guess, Javier, to piggyback off of that, in the trailer, there's a very compelling line that you say, I'll quote it, "We're going to have to unravel all the secrets that exist." You've come into this, you just talked about it. You know, you don't have an iron in the fire. You're investigating the story and what guys bring to the table here. I'm going to ask this question because if I don't, listeners will fry me if I don't ask this question. So let me play a devil's advocate a little bit. Is there any concern that the fallout from what you might discover would be, for lack of a better term, too historically great, so to speak? Or is this just a matter of human lives that were lost and you need to come in and get to the bottom of it? I mean, the world needs to know.
Well, it's both. It's human lives that were lost and the significance on the historical aspect of this. When you work a case, you work all sorts of different scenarios. You talk to witnesses, surveillance, you do your research. Again, yes, it's people, Americans that were killed. It's related to Amelia Earhart, the rescue. If proven true, right, it's going to change. This will be the first terrorism, I think we even mentioned back then. So, of course, this is very exciting. And that's just why, you know, I wanted to get involved.
Jim, you know, as we've mentioned a couple times so far tonight, I mean, obviously you bring so much to the table. I mean, what's your main difference of opinion since the last 2 years? I mean, we talked a couple of years ago about this. It was newer to you then. Obviously, you were still neck deep in it. But I mean, what's the main difference in opinion, I think, really, you know, 2 years later for you?
You know, it's really the conviction that this is a mystery that should not be left to speculation. We need to get back there and we need to go find out what's going on. And we now have the tools to do it. And I realized talking to Guy, they've done a lot of good work. They use ground penetrating radar and they use a lot of good approaches. But when we looked at the reality that this area might have been broken up in the early 1970s with some construction work that was done, I was like, how do you find these pieces, these bones or teeth and things? And I thought, search dogs. You know, I have a SAR dog myself. I'm a Tech 2 search and rescue. Used to be attached as a volunteer SAR to Sheriff's Department in California. And my search dog, Sadie, she unfortunately passed away earlier this year. But, you know, I thought that search dogs would find this. Metal detectors won't do it. And we got to get a dog out there. And that's when we realized we now know where it is because of this pillar. We have a pretty good idea. And if it got pushed a little ways, the dogs will find it. And they'll find it quick. I think they'll find it within the first 30 minutes. And this is just not something that this is the time to walk away from. This is going to be the adventure of a lifetime. It's going to be a great expedition. And somebody needs to go close the book on this. We can't leave it now. We're like at the last bit of years and years, decades of FOIA is an information act, Freedom of Information Act request, and all this work. It's a guy's life work. And here we are. We got the dogs. We're going to go. And I think it's time to go figure this out and see if it's there.
Guy, I don't think I've ever asked you this, but the idea that the story of, as we've talked about a little bit tonight, about the Lost Clipper might tie to, I'm biased probably, but the biggest aviation icon ever really is what? A million to one shot? A 10 million to one shot? I mean, do you remember your initial thoughts when you realized, holy shit, this might be the case?
Yeah, because I've never considered myself an Amelia or Earhart Hunter. That's a really specific type of research and history. You know, it's a well-beaten path. There's various different angles to it. You know, there's a lot of theories out there. And I never really wanted to be conflated as a, because people always ask me all these Earhart questions. I'm like, I really don't know. I mean, I just know little bits of what I've gotten. But, you know, this project has had a cast a shadow that we're not going to solve her mystery, but we are going to move it in a couple different directions that maybe no one had ever known. Chris, I will give you a bombshell right now on your show.
Hell yes. Please do.
And here is something that no one else on the planet has. But I have it now.
All right.
So here we go. I don't know if you know the name of General Jack Singlob.
Yes. Okay. And the hair on the back of my neck just stood up. And I'll tell you why when you're done.
Okay. So I am the last person to interview him alive. I interviewed him 3 months before he passed away. And on camera, three times, I asked General Singlob, did the United States know that the Japanese had captured Amelia Earhart? He said yes, three times, and gave me some details. So as far as I know, I have on tape the most senior American official, I guess, or possibly, you know, two-star general in his living room on camera telling me the United States knew that the Japanese had captured Amelia Earhart, but couldn't do anything about it because it would reveal our codes, that we were reading and intercepting Japanese communications. And it was far more important to keep that quiet than to rescue Amelia Earhart. So This is the first time in public this has been announced, but I'm using your show to announce it.
Well, all right. Now let me tell you my side of that real quick, because when you mentioned Jack, when you mentioned Singlob, like, as I said, I got a light bulb went off in my head, because I am neck deep in the D.B. Cooper book. I'm writing my second book right now on the D.B. Cooper, on the skyjacking case. Right. And the suspect that we're presenting in the book is sort of our dark horse D.B. Cooper suspect, is a gentleman by the name of Ted B. Braden. Now, if you Google Ted B. Braden, a lot of stuff will come up with regarding Cooper, but he was also a very high ranking officer within the MACV SOGS. This guy lied about his age to enlist in World War II. He fought at the Battle of the Bulge at 16 years old. He was in Vietnam. He was a commando. He was a mercenary. And one of his commanding officer way back when in MACV SOG, and one of his best friends, was Jack Singlob. So that messed me up bad. I'm shaking. That messed me up pretty bad when you said that, because this is not planned. We did not know that you were going to mention Jack Singlob on a bombshell like that. So that's what this show's all about. Very cool. I love when cases connect by 6 degrees of separation a little bit. It's really wild. Love that.
Wait till you get his bill.
Right. For dropping. Right. Yeah. All right.
I still owe Steve some money, so it will come in handy.
Okay. Well, there you go. All right. So as I mentioned, you know, we talk about the skyjack, we talk about D.B. Cooper a little bit. Steve, I'm into Cooper. I'm really into that right now. Major, that's my next big thing. He skyjacks a plane. He jumps out with $200,000, which is about $1.5 million. Very famous story, obviously, you know, $1.5 million today, I should say, value. Very famous story. These are sort of rogue Japanese agents, as you guys talk about in the trailer, that are stowing away in the tail of this aircraft and then proceeding to hijack it. No one had ever done this, by the way, at that point, at least recorded. No one had ever done it. Just how difficult the task would that have been, do you think? I mean, just generally, I mean, that's an incredible, remarkable task.
Well, it was. And my understanding is that the plane was under guard at the time on a military base, on a U.S. military base. So the fact that the guards saw two, I think they referred to them as Filipino, is that right?
Yeah, two guy? Filipino flight mechanics.
You know, if you're not familiar with the different ethnic groups in that part of the world, I believe it would be very easy to mistake a Filipino possibly for a Japanese, or vice versa, or an Asian person, you know. And it wasn't unusual. Everybody knew that plane was going to sit there overnight and take off the next morning. So you would do maintenance on it because it's going over open water and you want to make sure everything's good. And of course the pilots are going to do their checks before they take off, the pre-flight checks and everything. If they went on the plane, that's not unusual. They identified themselves. Maybe there was a shift change and the guards going off duty forgot to tell the guards coming on duty oh, by the way, there's two workmen on the plane, you know, and you think about it. I mean, they're probably tired at the end of their shift. It's nighttime and they either want to go have a drink or they want to go home, go to bed. And these are all guesstimations on my part as to how I believe this happened. But I'm basing this on what I know from Guy's stories and all his research. And
yeah.
I mean, hours and hours we spent talking. If you look at today's aircraft, to me, the first time Guy told me that, I thought, that doesn't quite, you know, meet muster here, because we've all been on commercial airliners, right? And where would you hide inside of a commercial airliner? You're not going to get in the cargo compartment because you might have a hard time getting out. And you know, nowadays you'd go in an altitude where you needed oxygen, you'd probably die. Well, back then the flights didn't go that high. And if you look at the dimensions of these Clipper series aircraft, they're massive. I mean, it's like the Empire State Building with wings and four engines on it out there. It's just massive. The ability for them to secrete themselves on there, I believe, would have been fairly easy. Now, it's still a huge risk, but if you're involved in spy work, you know, you're accustomed to that type of risk. I don't think it was that monumental for them to do. I'm sure they weighed all their options. They probably came up with different scenarios. I doubt if they just came up one day and said, hey, let's go hide out on the back of that plane over there. And when it takes off, we'll skyjack it, you know. I think it was all planned out. And honestly, there never been a skyjacking. So who's going to suspect that there wasn't the word skyjacking probably didn't even exist back then. So who's going to suspect that there are evil people on the plane that might cause it to crash? You know, if the pilots had said, we're not taking this plane anywhere. The two spies shot the pilots. Well, what's going to happen? Everybody's going to die because they're going to crash, right? It sounds illogical to think that something like that could happen based on today's standards. We're talking 1938. So I honestly believe that's what happened.
You know, it's hard for people to relate, like he said, with an airliner today, but these things would have been extremely loud. You've got these large props turning. So if you're hiding, it's not like you have to be super quiet. The back of this plane had a lot of storage things where people could hide. And what's really interesting is, to me, the hardest thing would be making sure you just hide. But what's interesting is, what are you going to do if you're going to hijack this plane? I was thinking about it from the pilot perspective. You got the navigator and engineer above the pilot. And, you know, if you're back there trying to hijack it, what's the number one first thing you need to do? And that is isolate the communication. You know, they had two radios. They had Morse code. They had they could send an SOS immediately. You want to stop that. So what do? You're hidden in the back of this plane. Well, guess what? The airplane went out of communication at the halfway point in the most remote part of the Pacific, halfway between Guam and Philippines, where communication could only be done through the long-range Stinger antenna coming out the tail, you know, the 500-foot long wire out the tail that you can only run when you're up in the air. You can't land with that out. They have another small antenna for local communication when they pull that in for landing so they can land safely and talk to the people at the airport. You can't get anybody on the short antenna when you're out in the middle, halfway between Guam and Philippines. And that's where communication goes out.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is the radio officer tries to talk to the Philippines. They ask for a weather report. And he says, hold on, I'm getting air static, which can happen from rain and dust and things hitting the antenna. And then all of a sudden, they never hear from him again. And if you look at this antenna in the back, I looked at the design of it. You could literally, if you're in the back of the plane, reach out and grab it where it comes off the spool and start pulling it in. You pull that antenna in, you're in the back of the plane, it's loud, nobody knows. All of a sudden, they're static because you're touching it and you're grounded, you're kind of shunted, grounded to the plane.
Right.
You get that static, you pull it in. All of a sudden, there's no radio communication. And there's no way to get it because you just pulled that in. Now you've got control of communication. Now you can go forward and take over the plane in the most remote, perfect location to do it, halfway between Guam and the Philippines.
That's remarkable. Jim, I actually, now that you mentioned that, every time I have a celestial navigator on the show, I always like to ask him this question. I know it's a little bit of a sidestep tonight, but can you just give me your opinion on Fred Noonan's abilities? You know, people talk a lot about Fred Noonan being an alcoholic, and I don't know, you know, how much you looked into that, but how good of a navigator really was Fred Noonan?
Well, I didn't know the individual, but everything I see from his history is he was tops. I mean, he was a teacher. He set the standards. You know, he set up all the navigation for Pan Am to all these stops we're talking about right now.
That's right.
Guam, the Philippines. He set all that up. Now, I don't know about the alcoholic stuff at all. And, you know, if someone's impaired, they're impaired, whatever. But this is somebody who knew it. That's all. I mean, this guy knew what he was doing. Come on. You know, I don't think that should be something in question. I think he's obviously a top-notch navigator. And gosh, I suspect, my guess would be that's why Amelia Earhart would have chosen him, because she's gone on this adventure all around the planet. And at that time, you need to really know what you're doing. You know, and you're going from the northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. You've got all these calculation changes happening. You want somebody that knows what they're doing, and they've been there before. And if you even think about you know, I know you're into the Earhart thing. Where the error happened is where he set up the Pacific Traverse for Pan Am, which is the area he really was good at, right? Going to Hawaii and then out to the Philippines. So that guy knew what he was doing.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah. I mean, I always ask because there's controversy there, and I want to make it crystal clear that Noonan was, you know, I say this all the time ad nauseum, but if you're going to go on a flight like that, that would have been the guy you want to have in the flight with you is Fred Noonan. So there's no question. Thank you for that. Javier, earlier you touched on a little bit about talking to extended family of the Clipper crew and sort of being able to converse with them and be able to talk about, you know, different things and hear their side of the story, their connections. You talked about being able to tell who may be embellishing a little bit, misremembering, and then who is absolutely straight arrow telling you the truth. How do you do that as an investigator? I mean, I know that's a whole podcast in and of itself, I know, but how do you do that? How does one do that from your position?
Yeah, there's a, well, you know, and I go back on our experience, Steve and I. I mean, you know, we do this for a living with DEA interviewing, you know, informants, witnesses, and you know what? I teach a class on the use of informants. You know, I always tell the young police officers, young agents, you do not believe them until you corroborate something. Once you get that corroboration, it checks out. And I stress corroboration. What does she have to gain? First of all, you got to look at the motive. Why, mm-hmm. you know, she loved her dad and, you know, but she just remembers that meeting where he got all the family together. They were under a tree. I mean, the details. Her dad was worried, was nervous, and basically says, hey, I may not be coming back. Again, going back to people talking to you, it's a knack, and you know, there's always signs, but like I said, the main thing is, and we've corroborated what she was talking about. As a matter of fact, right, guys, she had the newspaper article that later on came up, and Pan Am was being also very secretive. They didn't want to tell after, right, guy? Didn't she? I remember that.
Absolutely. That you're very correct.
So she was, in my opinion, I mean, she was telling the truth, and we need to listen to what she said because it just corroborated.
Yeah. And I'll jump in. She also noted that she saw multiple times FBI men coming to speak to them. And none of them spoke Spanish. So the father would be speaking to Jose's wife, Frugia, I think her name was, and would say things in Spanish, but they kept dancing around the word Amelia Earhart. So they started saying A-E, A-E. They went to get her, the flying lady, A-E. But they wouldn't say Amelia because the Pan Am guys didn't want them saying anything about Amelia to the FBI, who was investigating everything and everyone.
When you make a declaration like this, I mean, this is a pretty astounding declaration. If this ties together, if this is actually the case, again, you know, rewriting history, like we've talked so much, you know, about in Chasing Earhart and this whole thing we've been doing. Let me ask you sort of an interesting question. You must have to consider all of that it encompasses, all the behind the scenes drama, all the infighting, all that stuff. Does any of that detract you from going all the way here? Or is it just practical? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, does any of that matter? Should any of that matter? Or are you just laser focused on the data and on pushing forward here?
It flavors it. It definitely has a flavor to it. We all got to have dinner with Major Spooner from Quantico, and he pulls out the bandana, I believe, that he said Amelia Earhart wore before she was executed in Saipan, and then later cremated 2 weeks later, because everyone on the island was saying, oh, they captured the flying lady, the lady who wore pants, the lady with red hair, the lady who wore dressed like a man. According to him, they dug the body up and then cremated her, but they left the bandana, I don't know what they call it, the eye mask, face mask.
Yeah, like a handkerchief. Mike Harris talked about that. Him and Buddy Brenner were the one that dug it up. Yeah.
Yeah, and they dug it up, and they knew exactly, go to the breadfruit tree and 6 feet down, and they're digging, and boom, there it is. I mean, what are the odds? Again, what are the odds of finding that? And they sent it to Dover Air Force Base to have it analyzed, but it only had sweat on it, didn't have any blood, so they couldn't pull any DNA off of it. But when you start looking at these little breadcrumbs, they all form a trail if you stand far enough. And I see it almost like string theory. You have all these strings, And you pull on this one and it pulls that one. That's like how this Earhart thing is for me. It was the motivation, from what I understand, for the crew to fly with these $3 million in gold banknotes by Wasson Choi at the height of the Great Depression. I mean, how does a restaurateur who has some tea houses in New Jersey and New York have $3 million for Chinese relief? You know, what are the odds? That never happened before, as far as I know. And of course, you have the Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, who is working with FDR, and FDR in a bunch of books, especially, you know, For the President's Eyes Only and a couple other books. FDR is using his very wealthy socialite friends, like the Rockefellers, like the Lindberghs, like Astor. He doesn't quite believe what the Army and the Navy are giving him intel, so he wants these guys to use their own aircraft and ships and vessels to spy and intercept German and Japanese communications. So, of course, you know, if Lindbergh is flying German planes, you know, for the Luftwaffe, and he's taking pictures of the airfields, and apparently Earhart had a camera on her plane, because we have the documents from Eastman Kodak that she was looking at a new Bausch & Lomb lens that was going onto a camera that was going to get fitted to her plane. Now, we know she had a Brownie. Mm-hmm. Why would you need a camera facing in one direction that you would click with a button? You know, after the Air Force said, hey, we know you crashed your first plane, we'll pay for the second plane, but we want to do some modifications to it. You start adding all these things, you know, you look at the, you know, what Amelia Earhart's assistant, she wrote, imagine me, Amelia Earhart, a spy. And she underlines that in the side notes. When you add all these little puzzle pieces together, you start getting a picture. And again, I'm not an Earhart hunter. I'm a Lost Clipper hunter. But it does show a motivation, as Javier just said, a motivation of why people do the things that they do. Mm-hmm. Why was the crew, you know, acting very peculiar the night before? Why did they have a crew meeting, which they never usually do, all in the living room of Walker, you know, house? And his sister, who is there visiting, takes note and says, hey, all the pilots are talking to each other and they're very nervous. Why are they nervous now? Because they've never been nervous before when this is a routine mission. Why did Walker open up the window on the side and wave goodbye to his sister when he's never, ever done before? Why did he leave a note behind saying, hey, if I don't get back in 2 weeks, please take care of my new Ford? You know, there's a whole bunch of elements that are happening that when you put them all together is very, very suspicious. And again, my background is not in researching the human psychology. This goes to Steve Murphy and Javier Pena, who are experts. They track down the world's number one narco terrorist. If they can do that, then they definitely can look at an 80-year-old cold case, start asking questions. And while we're in the island, we're interviewing folks, and Steve is hearing stories I had never heard. He's pulling from people saying, yeah, we heard these American songs that were taught to the local people that were being sung from this Army medical facility.
Yeah.
They were there for 4 or 5 days. They were all blindfolded in the back of a truck. We think there's like 12 or 15 of them. They're recounting these stories, you know, because not a whole lot happens there. So little stories tend to be retold over and over and over again, and they might be embellished. Mm. But the true thing is, something happened. We know where it happened. We know when it happened. We have a good idea why it happened. But the only way to prove it, to get that smoking gun, is to use those dogs that Jim has been speaking about, who are very precise. And he has a method already designed that we're going to find this DNA and then match that DNA to the living female relatives of Jose Cepeda. And that is our smoking gun. We get that. And then we answer this part of history. We find out, yes, the bodies were interred here. The plane is not here. The plane, we believe, was destroyed and burnt to the ground by General MacArthur in 1946. And we have two eyewitnesses who are very high caliber who verified that, two different people. So we have a chain of custody that's unbroken. And the only thing in the middle that's keeping us from the beginning and the end is finding that DNA strand. So now we're basically in the mode of raising money up to the tune of $200,000 to pay for the dog search team, the DNA test, and the recovery team going sifting of all the debris. No one's getting a dollar. No one's getting paid a nickel for this. It's all going 100% research. And also for your listeners, Michael Bay, the director of Armageddon and Ambulance and Transformers, has reached out and he's interested in producing a film through his Bay Films company. Spoke with the president of Bay Films, Mike Case, last week, and they're interested in turning this story into a film.
Mm-hmm.
We've got interest. We just need to answer that one little thing.
Steve, you heard just heard Guy. He's fired up about it. His passion is there. It's obvious. It's been 85 years since Noonan and Earhart disappeared this year. Does the age of this case make it more difficult for you guys to do what you normally do? Or is it business as usual?
It's obviously a lot more difficult. You know, I was never a history major in school. So, you know, just, and believe it or not, I wasn't born in 1938. It was much later than that. I know I looked that old, but in the technology, I mean, we're used to dealing with what's available today, not what they did not have back during that time. The fact that the crime scene is on the other side of the world, that is a logistical nightmare just to get there. Like Guy said, you know, we all chipped in money and went on this trip to see if we could help out. And the trips that he went on before we got involved, mm-hmm. you know, he's pulling the money out of his own pocket. And I don't know if you're married, but your wife's not real mm-hmm. happy when you do things like that. So
My wife is. She supports me.
That's your story and you're sticking to it. She supports me, right?
Right, Vanessa? She'll hear this. Yeah, she supports me. Yeah, please continue.
But, you know, what it boils down to is the importance of this case, in my opinion. So we all took oaths to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Our jobs were to protect Americans. Just because we all retired, that doesn't mean our oaths ever expired. So here's an opportunity. That's why I say it's an adventure, because here's an opportunity that we might be able to bring closure to 15 families. I mean, think about it. If that was your dad or your granddad and you say, what happened to dad? He went on a flight and he never came home. Well, did he crash? Well, we don't know. Well, what happened to him? Where's dad? Did he leave us? Think of how that would make you feel personally.
Yeah.
You know, and so if we could bring closure to 15 families, I think we just hit a grand slam home run right there.
But amen to that. That
this could potentially be a tied to Amelia Earhart, which it certainly seems there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to support that theory right now. Mm-hmm. And I like the way that the guy says it, that we're not in competition with anybody. It would be great if somebody could find out what really happened to Amelia Earhart. Can we hold the people that are responsible accountable? Quite honestly, probably not all these years later.
Yeah.
But I think the focus of us is, it's an adventure that we would like to bring closure to. If we get to help out 15 families who have been in distress for, you know, since 1938, that's a godsend right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, you just heard Steve talk about, you know, the logistics of this. Bill Snavely and Buca and Project Blue Angel put $200,000 plus of his own money into that. He really wants to know. He wants to know if it's not Earhart, he wants to know who was in that plane. I feel like, you know, you guys are putting a lot of your money where your mouths are for this case and for this investigation. Talk a little bit about that. Expand on the difficulty that you guys are facing, because a lot of people think, oh, you could just go knock this out in a couple months. It's not a problem. But people don't realize that this takes a lot of time, and everybody's a critic and everybody's going to push and everybody's going to give you a hard time. Where do the resources go here? What do you want to see happen next? Talk a little bit about some of the difficulty you're experiencing and some of the challenges you're having to overcome.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about some of those, but let me make a comment build a little bit off of Steve's comment, because if the evidence here points to the right direction and Amelia Earhart was a prisoner, maybe she would be technically a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
And this was a mission to rescue a prisoner of war. And these folks have gone MIA. We're talking about 9 crew and 6 passengers, but aren't we obligated to return these bodies back to the United States if they're MIA?
Absolutely.
I mean, we do it in other wars and things, right? If this was government sanctioned, I think we got to do the right thing for the families and for these folks. So
amen,
I think there's
that.
A good obligation there. But anyway, I just want to add that to his, because I think about that at times.
Yeah.
When you work in search and rescue, a lot of times the families come out when you're starting the search, and there's the human factor in this is huge. It's not like TV. It is palpable. You know, anyway, that's a big part of it. You know, the difficulties, we try to strip this down to just what needs to be done. So we're not adding a lot of cost, right? Keep in mind, you're going to a very remote area. There's no power on the island. The water systems are crude. This is a real remote island. I mean, it's basic. I mean, we have to take a boat over to that and bring our own water and food and things. And it's a real adventure. The people who live on the island itself are living a real, you know, earthy environment. And it's kind of adds to the fun and adventure. And maybe it's also helped a little bit to preserve the area since it hasn't been heavily developed, so that we can actually get to the parts that we need to get to solve the mystery. But just getting there, is a big trip. And then bringing the equipment. And then if you want to communicate back, you're going to need a satellite uplink. And then if you want that, you're going to need a generator. This is a real adventure. This isn't like just going up to the mountains here and staying in a chalet or something. There's every little part of that. And I'll tell you, the tough part with the dogs is we've got to bring at least two dog teams, because you have to proof the two dog teams. And if something happens to one of the dogs, gets tired, or, you know, you got to make sure you have two dogs. And the dogs do not operate well in high heat and humidity. It makes it really hard for the dogs. So you have to cater to the dogs, not just on the planes, which a long plane trip is difficult on these dogs, which tend to be working line dogs. They're not the kind that, you know, just sit around and do nothing. These dogs have energy and they want to get out and do things, and they're not be real happy with a 16 hours on a plane. So you have to constantly cater to them. And then once they land, you have to have ways to cool them. You have to monitor them. They only work in short bursts. You don't want one dog to see the other dog when it's working so that they can proof each other. The dogs will be proofed against flags when they're in their training naturally. So we'll use different colored flags and have each dog run separate and then see where the flags are the same. Mm-hmm. So we've got all kinds of techniques that we need to run. We need to control the environment when we get there. I talked to, you know, Guy about this a little bit too, is technically you find human remains. I believe that becomes a crime scene because you don't know what you got until you know. So now you got to really control and be ready for that in a remote area. So you got to be ready to tape it off, guard it overnight, you know, make sure you do the right things, get the local authorities there. You know, for a remote area, it's a lot of things to get in place.
All right. Well, I won't take up too much more of everybody's time tonight. I do want to go. I'm going to go around robin and ask this next question, and then Guy will give you the last word and sort of add on a little something to that. I know this can be sometimes kind of be sort of an intimidating question a little bit, but I'll ask it anyway. Steve, 2022, it's 85 years. Amelia Earhart would be 125 years old if she was alive today. You know, everybody knows my opinion on Earhart on this call. Tell me what your thoughts are on maybe her legacy, just general thoughts, your personal opinion on why this case still matters, why Earhart still matters, why Noonan still matters. Tell everybody why they should care about Amelia Earhart in 2022.
Well, Earhart and Noonan, everybody knows who they are. Everybody, it's like the Pablo Escobar. You can ask people, hey, do you know Javier Pena and Steve Murphy? And they'll go, who? But if you ask anybody, do you know who Pablo Escobar is? Everybody knows. And it's the same thing with Amelia Earhart. Everybody knows. They have an idea of what her story is. They don't know the particulars like you do. And I mean, you've become an expert, you know, maybe one of the most world-renowned experts on her case. No, don't laugh.
Thank you. Every time I hear that, I feel a little unclean. But thank you, though. I appreciate it.
Well, wait till you get that bill too.
Yeah.
These compliments aren't free, Chris.
I'm telling you, I got them writing checks as we speak. Don't worry, we got you.
Yeah. It's just a mystery that's never been solved. We can put a man on the freaking moon? We've got people living in space right now. We're taking civilians up on these rocket rides. You know, if you got a buttload of money, you can go up in space. Why can we not solve this case in modern day in 2022? The clues are there. It's a matter of finding them. It's a matter of getting people to work towards a common goal and not work against each other, which you know, you hate to say this, but in law enforcement, that seems to happen a lot of times because we get very territorial about our investigations and we've put a lot of money and sweat equity into this. And I really don't want to tell you anything. That's not the right attitude here, because the goal should be finding out truthfully and realistically what happened to Amelia, what happened to the 15 Americans on the Hawaiian Clipper. Is it going to change my life? Is it going to change your life? Well, we'll have the personal satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Is it going to change the way the world turns? Is it going to turn the gravitational flow in the other direction? No, but it's that important. It is important to get this solved and dig. I mean, you got to dig as far as you can possibly go on these. I think Guy now has 22 years invested in this. Is that right? And he's shaking his head yes for the listeners out there, because they can't see you, Guy. It's a podcast, remember? You can tell who the idiot of this group is, right? But
it's me. It's me.
Truth yeah, no. You know.
Yeah, it's me.
I don't think so.
I'll raise my hand for that.
I just can't tell you how much I admire and respect everything that Guy's done. The fact that Jim is bringing his expertise on. I've ridden Javier Pena's coattails since I met him in 1991 in Colombia, and I'm still riding his coattails today. And the fact that he's on here, just, you know, I feel like I'm in great company. Jeff Riegel's unbelievable. Yeah. There's another cast member, Stephen Klaus, who was with us over in Micronesia on that last trip, that brings value. We had Ollie Dale from New Zealand come down with his professional photography and drones and all that. And the fact that all these professionals are coming together to work on one single case to try to bring closure to this thing It's just phenomenal. I keep saying the same thing, and I sound like a little fangirl here, but I'm just honored to be a part of this crew here. This is teamwork at the nth degree.
Javier, thoughts on that?
Yeah, basically the same. But you know, there's just too many pieces, right? It's almost, the puzzle is almost done, right? There's just a couple of pieces left, and with this group of experts, and again, we go by history. History, mm-hmm. And I think Steve said it best, how long has, we put, a man on the moon, we got people living out there, it's got to be solved. Imagine, like you said, and I just go back to when we talked to the captain's daughter, I mean, it's that peace of mind, and that's just one family, imagine 15 others.
Yeah.
And I think the experts that are all here, I think it's just a matter of time.
All right. Well, Jim, your thoughts on that? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been at this for a while now. You're in it. What are your thoughts? Why do people need to care?
You know, there's something really unique about this opportunity. Anytime somebody is trying to find physical evidence for Amelia Earhart, I don't care who they are, I am glued to the TV. I'm like, yeah. Somebody's out there looking under the water, looking wherever. I don't care who they are. I'm like, wow, real hard evidence, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we see the connection, potential connection here to Amelia Earhart with the interviews and the families. We actually have this narrowed down, and we're talking about DNA evidence. This will be irrefutable physical evidence. We need to stop letting it sit there and degrade in the ground now and go back and look at it. We've got all the other circumstantial evidence and documents and interviews and two-star generals and all this stuff. But you find that evidence and those bodies there, which is nowhere near the flight path. There's no way for those bodies to float down there. All of a sudden, you have to be like, it happened. And guess
Checkmate.
What? The rest of the story is true too. Mm-hmm. It's that physical hard evidence that isn't always there. It's hard to get. And that's what this is the expedition to definitively get it. I think it needs to happen. It needs to happen soon.
All right. Well, before we wrap up tonight, Mr. Nofsinger, final word. Tell us a little bit about your personal thoughts on this 85th anniversary of Earhart Noonan's disappearance. I know it's been a couple of years, like I said, at the top of the show since you and I have talked. Why do people need to care? Why does this matter? And where can we help? How can we help as a listening audience?
Awesome. Thank you. Well, again, it's an honor to be here, especially with all these men and also recognizing our GPR guy. That was Bob Perry and Bill Stinnett, who was our host on the island multiple times. It's just been a wonderful experience. And thinking about Earhart, I think if I think about it, I look at it this way. As a Christian, I believe in Jesus Christ. And I believe in the history of the Bible. And lots of folks would never say, oh yeah, that's all faith. But then when you start going back into the Holy Land and you go to where, everything supposedly happened, and they start finding these ruins and they start finding these items, that they found, oh, here is actually Sodom and Gomorrah. Here's a piece of glass that was burnt at 4,000 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
You start finding this proof. I think all the proof is there. You just have to dig for it. It's there. Nothing disappears. It's just usually hidden. Time has a way of building layers upon layers upon layers of things. And when I look at that from that context, I think about the Clipper and I think about Earhart. The answer is there. The answer is definitely there. We just haven't found it yet. Thank God for people like you, Chris, and the team on the Clipper here, especially, Murphy and Javier and Jim and Jeff Regal and Bob and Bill and Stephen Klaus and Maxim Jago and Ollie Dale and all these other folks that really helped us and you, because we are the people, including you, we are the people who don't give up.
Yeah.
We are the people who know the answer is out there. We just have to find it. And their legacy, their lineage, their memory never dies, because we are still living it. We're still pushing every day. We're getting those FOIAs. We're reading those articles. We're turning over those rocks. We're looking for those things. And if we find that one little bit of evidence, that could be the tiny little microscopic key that turns the lock and opens everything. And that's what I think is. I think, we are comrades in arms. We know that we will solve this case sooner or later, because we are diligent enough that we will solve this. We just have to remain faithful and keep moving forward, not giving up, encouraging each other when we get down. We're like, oh, I don't know if this is ever going to happen. If we're resolute, we will solve these mysteries and many, many others, like Steve said, you know, we have walked on the moon. We're sending people to Mars eventually. We've done many, many things. We can do this. We just can't give up.
Well, on that note, let's get out of here tonight. Where can people follow the project online? Guy, please plug away, sir.
Sure. LostClipper.com. LostClipper.com. That's where you can read more about what we're looking for. And we, Jim has designed a beautiful patch called Expedition 5. And that is going to be our fifth and final trip back to Micronesia. We're going to start raising money again. We raised like $6,000 or $7,000 in our first try. That's nothing. So we eventually just sent all that money back to everyone who gave us a dollar because we couldn't do anything with that. We need at a minimum 180,000. We're hoping for at least around 200K, and that's going to be enough to cover everybody.
This has been a hell of a conversation tonight. This has been really cool. I appreciate this. You know, we got into this years ago, 20 years of my own life, longer than that, unofficially. And I'm filled with renewed optimism, especially with this batch of episodes, with a lot of the folks that are really passionately arguing on behalf of why we should care about this case and on theory and on what they're doing and on the active investigations. This has been an absolute honor. I want to thank everybody, all of you, Steve Murphy, Javier Pena, Guy Nofsinger, Jim Janicki, Jeff Riegel for setting this up. Thank you very much. And the entire Lost Clipper team. We will have all the links to everything we talked about in the show notes tonight. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you all so much for doing this.
Thank you, awesome. Chris.
Thank you. Sorry.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. Copyright 2022. All rights reserved.